slowly. When this is over, I shall miss it very much.
Yes.
I do not mean the fighting.
No.
Well, Lee said. He looked to the sky. It is all in God's hands.
They said good night.
Longstreet watched the old man back to his tent. Then he mounted and rode alone back to his camp to begin the turning of the army, all the wagons and all the guns, down the narrow mountain road that led to Gettysburg. It was still a long, dark hour till dawn. He sat alone on his horse in the night, and he could feel the army asleep around him, all those young hearts beating in the dark. They would need their rest now. He sat alone to await the dawn, and let them sleep a little longer. 2. Chamberlain. He dreamed of Maine and ice-black water. He awoke to a murderous sun. A voice was calling, "Colonel Darlin!" He squinted. The whiskery face of Buster Kilrain.
"Colonel Darlin, I hate to be waking you, but there's a message here you ought to be seeing."
Chamberlain had slept on the ground. He rolled to a sitting position. Light boiled in through the tent flap. Chamberlain closed his eyes.
"And how are you feeling this morning, Colonel, me lad?"
Chamberlain ran his tongue around his mouth. He said briefly, dryly,
"Ach! We're about to be having guests, sir, or I wouldn't be waking you."
Chamberlain looked up through bleary eyes. He had walked 80 miles in 4 days through the hottest weather he had ever known, and he had gone down with sunstroke. He felt an eerie fragility, like a piece of thin glass in a high, hot wind. He saw a wooden canteen held in the big hand of Kilrain, cold drops of water on varnished sides. He drank. The world focused.
120 men,
Kilrain said. Chamberlain peered at him.
"They should be arriving any moment,"
Kilrain said. He was squatting easily, comfortably, in the opening of the tent, the light flaming behind him.
"Who?" Chamberlain said. "They are sending us some mutineers,"
Kilrain said with fatherly patience.
120 men from the old Second Maine, which has been disbanded."
"Mutineers?"
"Aye. What happened was that the enlistment of the old Second ran out, and they were all sent home except 120, which had foolishly signed 3-year papers. And so they all had 1 year to go. Only they all thought they were signing up to fight with the Second, and Second only, and so they mutinied. 120. Are you all right, Colonel?"
Chamberlain nodded vaguely.
"Well, these poor fellows did not want to fight no more, naturally, being Maine men of a certain intelligence, and refused. Only nobody'll send them home, and nobody knew what to do with them, until they thought of us, being as we are the other Maine regiment here in the army. There's a message here signed by Meade himself. That's the new general we got now, sir, if you can keep track as they go by. The message says they'll be sent here this morning, and they are to fight. And if they don't fight, you can feel free to shoot them."
"Shoot?"
"Aye."
"Let me see." Chamberlain read painfully. His head felt very strange indeed, but he was coming awake into the morning, as from a long way away, and he could begin to hear the bugles out across the fields. Late to get moving today. Thank God. Somebody gave us an extra hour. Bless 'em. He read. "You are therefore authorized to shoot any man who refuses to do his duty."
"Shoot?"
he said.
"These are all Maine men?" "Yes, sir. Fine big fellers. I've seen 'em. Logging men. You may remember there was a bit of a brawl some months back during the Mud March. These fellers were famous for their fists."
Chamberlain said, 120.
"Yes, sir."
"Somebody's crazy."
"Yes, sir."
How many men do we now have in this regiment?
Ah, somewhat less than 250, sir, as of yesterday, counting the officers.
How do I take care of 120 mutinous men?
Yes, sir,
Kilrain sympathized.
Well, you'll have to talk to them, sir.
Chamberlain sat for a long moment, silently trying to function. He was 34 years old, and on this day 1 year ago he had been a professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin University. He had no idea what to do. But it was time to go out into the sun. He crawled forward through the tent flap and stood up, blinking, swaying, one hand against the bole of a tree. He was a tall man, somewhat picturesque. He wore stolen blue cavalry trousers and a 3-foot sword, and the clothes he wore he had not taken off for a week. He had a grave, boyish dignity, that clean-eyed, scrubbed-brained, naive look of the happy professor. Kilrain, a white-haired man with the build of an ape, looked up at him with fatherly joy.
"If you'll ride the horse today, Colonel, which the Lord hath provided, instead of walking in the dust with the other fools, you'll be all right. If you wear the hat. It's the walking, do you see, that does the great harm."
"You walked," Chamberlain said grumpily, thinking,
"Shoot them? Maine men? How can I shoot Maine men? I'll never be able to go home." "Ah, but Colonel, darling, I've been in the infantry since before you was born. It's them first few thousand miles. After that, a man gets a limber to his feet."
"Hey, Lawrence! How you doing?" Younger brother Tom Chamberlain, bright-faced, high-voiced, a new lieutenant, worshipful. The heat had not seemed to touch him. Chamberlain nodded. Tom said critically,
"You looking kind of peaked. Why don't you ride the horse?"
Chamberlain gloomed. But the day was not as bright as it had seemed through the opening of the tent. He looked upward with relief toward a darkening sky. The troops were moving in the fields, but there had been no order to march. The wagons were not yet loaded. He thought, God bless the delay. His mind was beginning to function. All down the road and all through the trees, the troops were moving, cooking. The thousands of troops and thousands of wagons of the 5th Corps, Army of the Potomac, of which Chamberlain's 20th Maine was a minor fragment. But far down the road, there was motion. Kilrain said, "There they come." Chamberlain squinted. Then he saw troops on the road, a long way off. The line of men came slowly up the road. There were guards with fixed bayonets. Chamberlain could see the men shuffling. Strange, pathetic spectacle. Dusty, dirty, ragged men, heads down, faces down. It reminded him of a history book picture of impressed seamen in the last war with England. But these men would have to march all day in the heat. Chamberlain thought, not possible. Tom was meditating.
"Gosh, Lawrence! There's almost as many men there as we got in the whole regiment. How are we going to guard them?"
Chamberlain said nothing. He was thinking. How do you force a man to fight for freedom? The idiocy of it jarred him. Think on it later. Must do something now. There was an officer, a captain, at the head of the column. The captain turned them in off the road and herded them into an open space in the field near the regimental flag. The men of the regiment, busy with coffee, stood up to watch. The captain had a loud voice and used obscene words. He assembled the men in two long, ragged lines and called them to attention, but they ignored him. One slumped to the ground, more exhaustion than mutiny. A guard came forward and yelled and probed with a bayonet, but abruptly several more men sat down, and then they all did. And the captain began yelling, but the guard stood grinning confusedly, foolishly, having gone as far as they would go, unwilling to push further unless the men here showed some threat. And the men seemed beyond threat, merely enormously weary. Chamberlain took it all in as he moved toward the captain. He put his hands behind his back and came forward slowly, studiously. The captain pulled off dirty gloves and shook his head with contempt, glowering up at Chamberlain.
Looking for the commanding officer, 20th Maine.
You found him, Chamberlain said.
That's him, all right.
Tom's voice behind him, very proud. Chamberlain suppressed a smile.
You, Chamberlain?
The captain stared at him grimly, insolently, showing what he thought of Maine men. Chamberlain did not answer for a long moment, looking into the man's eyes, until the eyes suddenly blinked and dropped, and then Chamberlain said softly, "Colonel Chamberlain to you." The captain stood still for a moment, then slowly came to attention, slowly saluted. Chamberlain did not return it. He looked past the captain at the men, most of whom had their heads down, but there were eyes on him. He looked back and forth down the line, looking for a familiar face that would help, but there was no one he knew.
Captain Brewer, sir. 118 Pennsylvania.
The captain tugged in his coat front, produced a sheaf of papers. If you're the commanding officer, sir, then I present you with these here prisoners. He handed the papers. Chamberlain took them, glanced down, handed them back to Tom. The captain said,
You're welcome to them, God knows. Had to use the bayonet to get them moving. You got a sign for them, Colonel.
Chamberlain said over his shoulder, Sign it, Tom. To the captain he said, You're relieved, Captain. The captain nodded, pulling on the dirty gloves.
You're authorized to use whatever force necessary, Colonel.
He said that loudly for effect.
If you have to shoot him, why, you go right ahead. Won't nobody say nothing.
You're relieved, Captain, Chamberlain said. He walked past the captain, closer to the men who did not move, who did not seem to notice him. One of the guards stiffened as Chamberlain approached, looked past him to his captain. Chamberlain said, You men can leave now. We don't need any guards. He stood in front of the men, ignoring the guards. They began to move off. Chamberlain stood for a moment, looking down. Some of the faces turned up. There was hunger and exhaustion and occasional hatred. Chamberlain said,
My name is Chamberlain. I'm Colonel, 20th Maine.
Some of them did not even raise their heads. He waited another moment. Then he said,
When did you eat last?
More heads came up. There was no answer. Then a man in the front row said huskily in a whiskey voice,
We're hungry, Colonel.
Another man said,
They've been trying to break us by not feeding us.
Chamberlain looked, a scarred man, hatless, hair plastered thinly on the scalp like strands of black seaweed. The man said,
We ain't broke yet.
Chamberlain nodded. A hard case. But we'll begin with food. He said,
They just told us you were coming a little while ago. I've told the cook to butcher a steer.
Hope you like it near raw, not much time to cook. Eyes opened wide. He could begin to see the hunger on the faces, like the yellow shine of sickness. He said,
We've got a ways to go today, and you'll be coming with us, so you better eat hearty.
We're all set up for you back in the trees. He saw Glazier Estabrook standing huge-armed and peaceful in the shade of a nearby tree. Glazier, Chamberlain said, you show these men where to go. You fellas eat up, and then I'll come over and hear what you have to say. No man moved. Chamberlain turned away. He did not know what he would do if they did not choose to move. He heard a voice. Colonel? He turned. The scarred man was standing. Colonel? We got grievances.
The men elected me to talk for him.
Right. Chamberlain nodded. You come on with me and talk. The rest of you fellas go eat. He beckoned to the scarred man and waved to Glazier Estabrook. He turned again, not waiting for the men to move off, not sure they would go, began to walk purposefully toward the blessed dark, wondering again how big a guard detail it would take. thinking he might wind up with more men out of action than in. And also, what are you going to say? Good big boys they are, seeing their share of action.
Gosh, Lawrence,
Tom Chamberlain said. Smile, Chamberlain said cheerily. And don't call me Lawrence. Are they moving? He stopped and glanced pleasantly backward, saw with delight that the men were up and moving toward the trees, toward food. He grinned, plucked a book from his jacket, handed it to Tom. Here, this is Casey's Manual of Infantry Tactics. You study it. Maybe someday you'll make a soldier. He smiled at the scarred man, extended a hand. What's your name? The man stopped, looked at him for a long, cold second. The hand seemed to come up against gravity, against his will, automatic courtesy. Chamberlain was relying on it. I'm not usually that informal, Chamberlain said, with the same light, calm, pleasant manner that he had developed when talking to particularly rebellious students, who had come in with a grievance and who hadn't yet learned that the soft answer turneth away wrath. Some wrath. But I suppose somebody ought to welcome you to the regiment? The man said, I don't feel too kindly, Colonel. Chamberlain nodded. He went on inside the tent, the scarred man following, and sat down on a camp stool, letting the man stand. He invited the man to have coffee, which the man declined, and then listened silently to the man's story. The scarred man spoke calmly and coldly, looking straight into Chamberlain's eyes. A good, stubborn man. There was a bit of a lawyer about him. He used chunky phrases about law and justice, but he had heavy hands with thick, muscular fingers and black fingernails, and there was a look of power to him, a coil tight set to the way he stood. Balanced, ugly, slightly contemptuous, but watchful. Trying to gauge Chamberlain's strength. Chamberlain said, I see. I've been in 11 different engagements, Colonel. How many you been in? Not that many, Chamberlain said. I've done my share. We all have. Most of us. He gestured out the tent flap into the morning glare. There's some of them no damn good. But most of them been all the way there and back. Damn good men. Shouldn't ought to use them this way. Looky here. He pulled up a pants leg. Chamberlain saw a purple gash, white scar tissue. The man let the pants leg fall. Chamberlain said nothing. The man looked at his face, seemed suddenly embarrassed, realized he had gone too far. For the first time he was uncertain, but he repeated, I done my share. Chamberlain nodded. The man was relaxing slowly. He was warm in the tent. He opened his shirt. Chamberlain said, What's your name?
Bucklin.
Joseph Bucklin. Where are you from?
Bangor.
Don't know any Bucklins.
Farmer?
Fisherman. Former Sergeant Kilrain put his head in the tent.
Colonel, there's a courier coming.
Chamberlain nodded. Bucklin said, I'm tired, Colonel. You know what I mean? I'm tired. I've had all of this army and all of these officers, this damned Hooker and this goddamned idiot Meade, all of them. The whole bloody, lousy, rotten mess of sick-brained, pot-bellied scabheads that ain't fit to lead a Johnny detail, ain't fit to pour pee out in a boot with instructions on the heel. I'm tired. We are good men, and we had our own good flag, and these goddamned idiots use us like we was cows or dogs or even worse. We ain't gonna win this war. We can't win nohow because of these lame-brained bastards from West Point, these goddamned gentlemen, these officers. Only one officer knew what he was doing, McClellan, and look what happened to him. I'd just as soon go home and let them damn Johnnies go home and the hell with it. He let it go, out of breath. He had obviously been waiting to say that to some officer for a long time. Chamberlain said, I get your point. Kilrain announced, Courier, sir. Chamberlain rose, excused himself, stepped out into the sunlight. A bright-cheeked lieutenant, just dismounted, saluted him briskly.
Colonel Chamberlain, sir. Colonel Vincent wishes to inform you that the Corps is moving out at once, and that you are instructed to take the advance. The 20th Maine has been assigned to the first position in line. You will send out flankers and advance guards.
My compliments to the colonel. Chamberlain saluted, turned to Kilrain and Ellis Spear, who had come up.
You heard him, boys. Get the regiment up. Sound the general. Strike the tents.
Back inside the tent, he said cheerfully to Buckland, We're moving out. You better go hurry up your eating. Tell your men I'll be over in a minute. I'll think on what you said. Buckland slipped by him, went away. Chamberlain thought, We're first in line.
Kilrain,
the former sergeant, was back.
Sir,
where are we headed?
West, sir. Pennsylvania somewhere. That's all I know.
Listen, Buster, you're a private now, and I'm not supposed to keep you at headquarters in that rank. If you want to go on back to the ranks, you just say so, because I feel obligated. Well, you don't have to be here, but listen. I need you.
Then I'll be staying, Colonel, laddie.
Kilrain grinned. But you know I can't promote you. Not after that episode with the bottle.
Did you have to pick an officer?
Kilrain grinned.
I was not aware of rank, sir, at the time. And he was the target which happened to present itself.
Buster, you haven't got a bottle about.
Is the colonel in need of a drink, sir?
I meant... Forget it. All right, Buster, move him out. Kilrain saluted, grinning, and withdrew. The only professional in the regiment. The drinking would kill him. Well, he would die happy. Now, what do I say to them? Tom came in, saluted.
The men from the 2nd Maine are being fed, sir.
Don't call me sir.
Well, Lawrence, great God almighty, you just be careful of that name business in front of the men. Listen, we don't want anybody to think there's favoritism.
Tom put on the wounded look, face of the ruptured deer.
General Meade has his son as his adjutant. That's different. Generals can do anything.
Nothing quite so much like God on earth as a general on the battlefield. The tent was coming down about his head. He stepped outside to avoid the collapse. The general and God was a nice parallel. They have your future in their hands, and they have all power and know all. He grinned, thinking of Meade surrounded by his angelic staff. Dan Butterfield, Wild Dan Sickles.
But what do I say? Lawrence, what are you going to do?
Chamberlain shook his head. The regiment was up and moving.
God, you can't shoot them. You do that, you'll never go back to Maine when the war's over.
I know that. Chamberlain meditated. Wonder if they do. He heard a flare of bugles, looked down the road toward Union Mills. The next regiment, the 83rd Pennsylvania, was up and forming. He saw wagons and ambulances moving out into the road. He could feel again the yellow heat. Must remember to cover up. More susceptible to sunstroke now. Can't afford a foggy head. He began to walk slowly toward the grove of trees. Kilrain says, tell the truth. Which is? Fight, or we'll shoot you. Not true. I won't shoot anybody. He walked slowly out into the sunlight. He thought, but the truth is much more than that. Truth is too personal. Don't know if I can express it. He paused in the heat. Strange thing. You would die for it without further question, but you had a hard time talking about it. He shook his head. I'll wave no more flags for home. No tears for mother. Nobody ever died for apple pie. He walked slowly toward the dark grove. He had a complicated brain, and there were things going on back there from time to time that he only dimly understood, so he relied on his instincts. But he was learning all the time. The faith itself was simple. He believed in the dignity of man. His ancestors were Huguenots, refugees of a chained and bloody Europe. He had learned their stories in the cradle. He had grown up believing in America and the individual, and it was a stronger faith than his faith in God. This was the land where no man had to bow. In this place, at last, a man could stand up, free of the past, free of tradition and blood ties and the curse of royalty, and become what he wished to become. This was the first place on earth where the man mattered more than the state. True freedom had begun here, and it would spread eventually over all the earth. But it had begun here. The fact of slavery upon this incredibly beautiful, new, clean earth was appalling. But more even than that was the horror of old Europe, the curse of nobility, which the South was transplanting to new soil. They were forming a new aristocracy, a new breed of glittering men, and Chamberlain had come to crush it. But he was fighting for the dignity of man, and in that way, he was fighting for himself. If men were equal in America, all these former Poles and English and Czechs and blacks, then they were equal everywhere. And there was really no such thing as a foreigner. There were only free men and slaves. And so it was not even patriotism, but a new faith. The Frenchman may fight for France, but the American fights for mankind, for freedom, for the people. Not the land. Yet the words had been used too often, and the fragments that came to Chamberlain now were weak. A man who has been shot at is a new realist. And what do you say to a realist when the war is a war of ideals? He thought finally, well, I owe them the truth at least. Might as well begin with that. The regiment had begun to form. Chamberlain thought, at least it'll be a short speech. He walked slowly toward the prisoners. Glazier Estabrook was standing guard, leaning patiently on his rifle. He was a thick little man of about 40. Except for Kilrain, he was the oldest man in the regiment, the strongest man Chamberlain had ever seen. He waved happily as Chamberlain came up, but went on leaning on the rifle. He pointed to one of the prisoners.
Hey, Colonel, you know who this is? This here is Dan Burns from Orono. I know his daddy. Daddy's a preacher. You really ought to hear him. Best damn cusser I ever heard. Knows more fine swear words than any man in Maine, I bet. Hee!
Chamberlain smiled. But the Burns boy was looking at him with no expression. Chamberlain said,
you fellas gather round.
He stood in the shade, waited while they closed in silently, watchfully around him. In the background the tents were coming down, the wagons were hitching, but some of the men of the regiment had come out to watch and listen. Some of the men here were still chewing, but they were quiet, attentive. Chamberlain waited a moment longer. Now it was quiet in the grove, and the clink of the wagons was sharp in the distance. Chamberlain said,
I've been talking with Bucklin. He's told me your problem.
Some of the men grumbled. Chamberlain heard no words, clearly. He went on speaking softly so that they would have to quiet to hear him.
I don't know what I can do about it. I'll do what I can. I'll look into it as soon as possible. But there's nothing I can do today. We're moving out in a few minutes, and we'll be marching all day, and we may be in a big fight before nightfall. But as soon as I can, I'll do what I can.
They were silent, watching him. Chamberlain began to relax. He had made many speeches, and he had a gift for it. He did not know what it was, but when he spoke, most men stopped to listen. Fanny said it was something in his voice. He hoped it was there now. I've been ordered to take you men with me. I've been told that if you don't come, I can shoot you. Well, you know, I won't do that. Not Maine men. I won't shoot any man who doesn't want this fight. Maybe someone else will, but I won't. So that's that. He paused again. There was nothing on their faces to lead him. Here's the situation. I've been ordered to take you along. And that's what I'm going to do. Under guard, if necessary. But you can have your rifles if you want them. The whole Reb army is up the road a ways waiting for us, and this is no time for an argument like this. I tell you this. We sure can use you. We're down below half strength, and we need you, no doubt of that. But whether you fight or not is up to you. Whether you come along, well, you're coming. Tom had come up with Chamberlain's horse. Over the heads of the prisoners, Chamberlain could see the regiment falling into line out in the flaming road. He took a deep breath. Well, I don't want to preach to you. You know who we are and what we're doing here. But if you're going to fight alongside us, there's a few things I want you to know. He bowed his head, not looking at eyes. He folded his hands together. This regiment was formed last fall back in Maine. There were 1,000 of us then. There's not 300 of us now. He glanced up briefly. But what is left is choice. He was embarrassed. He spoke very slowly, staring at the ground. Some of us volunteered to fight for Union. Some came in mainly because we were bored at home and this looked like it might be fun. Some came because we were ashamed not to. Many of us came because it was the right thing to do. All of us have seen men die. Most of us never saw a black man back home. We think on that, too. But freedom is not just a word. He looked up into the sky, over silent faces. This is a different kind of army. If you look at history, you'll see men fight for pay, or women, or some other kind of loot. They fight for land, or because a king makes them, or just because they like killing. But we're here for something new. This hasn't happened much in the history of the world. We're an army going out to set other men free. He bent down, scratched the black dirt into his fingers. He was beginning to warm to it. The words were beginning to flow. No one in front of him was moving. He said, "This is free ground. All the way from here to the Pacific Ocean. No man has to bow. No man born to royalty. Here we judge you by what you do, not by what your father was. Here you can be something. Here's a place to build a home. It isn't the land. There's always more land. It's the idea that we all have value, you and me. We're worth something more than the dirt. I never saw dirt I'd die for. But I'm not asking you to come join us and fight for dirt. What we're all fighting for in the end is each other." Once he started talking, he broke right through the embarrassment, and there was suddenly no longer a barrier there. The words came out of him in a clear river, and he felt himself silent and suspended in the grove, listening to himself speak, carried outside himself, and looking back down on the silent faces and himself speaking. And he felt the power in him. The power of his cause. For an instant he could see black castles in the air. He could create centuries of screaming, eons of torture. Then he was back in sunlit Pennsylvania. The bugles were blowing, and he was done. He had nothing else to say. No one moved. He felt the embarrassment return. He was suddenly enormously tired. The faces were staring up at him like white stones. Some heads were down. He said, "Didn't mean to preach. Sorry. But I thought, you should know who we are." He had forgotten how tiring it was just to speak. "Well, this is still the army, but you're as free as I can make you. Go ahead and talk for a while. If you want your rifles for this fight, you'll have them back and nothing else will be said. If you won't join us, you'll come along under guard. When this is over, I'll do what I can to see that you get fair treatment. Now we have to move out." He stopped, looked at them. The faces showed nothing. He said slowly, "I think if we lose this fight, the war will be over. So if you choose to come with us, I'll be personally grateful. We have to move out." He turned, left silence behind him. Tom came up with the horse, a pale gray, light-footed animal. Tom's face was shiny red. "My, Lawrence, you sure talk pretty." Chamberlain grunted. He was really tired. "Rest a moment." He paused with his hands on the saddle horn. There was a new vague doubt stirring in his brain. Something troubled him. He did not know why. "You ride today, Lawrence. You look weary." Chamberlain nodded. Ellis Spear was up. He was Chamberlain's ranking officer, an ex-teacher from Wiscasset, who was impressed with Chamberlain's professorship. A shy man, formal but very competent, he gestured toward the prisoners. "Colonel, what do you suggest we do with them?" "Give them a moment. Some of them may be willing to fight. Tom, you go back and see what they say. We'll have to march them under guard. Don't know what else to do. I'm not going to shoot them. We can't leave them here." The regiment had formed out in the road, the color bearers in front. Chamberlain mounted, put on the wide-brimmed hat with the emblem of the infantry, began walking his horse slowly across the field toward the road. The uneasiness still troubled him. He had missed something. He did not know what. Well, he was an instinctive man. His mind would tell him sooner or later. Perhaps it was only that when you try to put it into words, you cannot express it truly. It never sounds as you dream it. But then, you were asking them to die. Ellis Spear was saying, "How far are we from Pennsylvania, Colonel? You have any idea?" "Better than 20 miles. Chamberlain squinted upward. "Going to be another hot day." He moved to the head of the column. The troops were moving slowly, patiently, setting themselves for the long march. After a moment, Tom came riding up. His face was delighted. Chamberlain said, "How many are going to join us?" Tom grinned hugely. "Would you believe it? All but 6. "How many?" "I counted. By actual count, 114. "Well," Chamberlain rubbed his nose, astounded. Tom said, still grinning, "Brother, you did real good." "They're all marching together?" "Right. Glazier's got the 6 hardheads in tow." "Well, get all their names and start assigning them to different companies. I don't want them bunched up. Spread them out. See about their arms." "Yes, sir. Colonel, sir." Chamberlain reached the head of the column. The road ahead was long and straight, rising toward a ridge of trees. He turned in his saddle, looked back, saw the entire 5th Corps forming behind him. He thought, 120 new men. Hardly noticeable in such a mass, and yet he felt a moment of huge joy. He called for road guards and skirmishers, and the 20th Maine began to move toward Gettysburg. 3. Buford. The land west of Gettysburg is a series of ridges, like waves in the earth. The 1st Rebel Infantry came in that way, down the narrow gray road from the mountain gap. At noon they were in sight of the town. It was a small, neat place, whiteboard houses, rail fences, all in order, one white church steeple. The soldiers coming over the last ridge by the Lutheran seminary could see across the town to the hills beyond and a winding gray road coming up from the south. And as the first gray troops entered the town, there was motion on that southern road. A blur, blue movement, blue cavalry. They came on slowly around the last bend, a long, blue, smoking snake, spiked with guns and flags. The soldiers looked at each other across vacant fields. The day was very hot. The sky was a steamy haze. Someone lifted a gun and fired, but the range was too long. The streets of Gettysburg were deserted. Just beyond the town, there were two hills. One was wooded and green, the other was flat, topped by a cemetery. The Union commander, a tall, blonde, sunburned man named John Buford, rode up the long slope to the top of the hill into the cemetery. He stopped by a stone wall, looked down across flat, open ground, lovely, clear field of fire. He could see all the way across the town and the ridges to the blue mountains beyond, a darkening sky. On the far side of the town, there was a red brick building, the stately seminary, topped with a white cupola. The road by the building was jammed with rebel troops. Buford counted half a dozen flags. He had thought it was only a raiding party. Now he sensed power behind it, a road flowing with troops all the way back to the mountains. The 1st Blue Brigade had stopped on the road below by a red barn. The commander of that brigade, Bill Gamble, came up the hill on a muddy horse, trailed by a small cloud of aides, gazed westward with watery eyes. He wheezed, wiping his nose. By God, that's infantry! Buford put the glasses to his eyes. He saw one man on a black horse waving a plumed hat, an officer. The rebel troops had stopped. Buford looked around, searching for other movement. He saw a squad of blue troopers, his own men, riding down into deserted streets. Still no sound of gunfire. Gamble said, "That's one whole brigade. At least one brigade." "Do you see any cavalry?" Gamble swept the horizon, shook his head. Strange. Infantry moving alone in enemy country. Blind. Very strange. Gamble sneezed violently, wiped his nose on his coat, swore, wheezed. His nose had been running all that day. He pointed back along the ridge beyond the cemetery. "If you want to fight here, sir, it sure is lovely ground. We tuck in here behind this stone wall, and I'd be proud to defend it. Best damn ground I've seen all day." Buford said, "It is that." But he had only two brigades. He was only a scout. The big infantry was a long day's march behind him, but Gamble was right. It was lovely ground.
"By God! I think they're pulling back!"
Buford looked. The gray troops had turned. They had begun to withdraw back up the road. Slowly, very slowly. He could see back-turned faces, feel the cold defiance, but he felt himself loosen, begin to breathe.
"That's damn strange," Gamble sniffled. "What do you make of that?"
Buford shook his head. He rode slowly along the stone wall, suspending judgment. There was no wind at all. It was exactly noon. It was very quiet among the gravestones. Superb ground. He thought, they must have orders not to fight. Which means they don't know who we are or how many. Which means they have no cavalry. No eyes. He stopped by a white angel, arm uplifted, a stony sadness. For 5 days, Buford had been tracking Lee's army, shadowing it from a long way off as you track a big cat. But now, the cat had turned. Buford said aloud, "He's coming this way." "Sir?" Lee's turned. That's the main body.
"You think so?"
Gamble mused, wriggling his nose.
"Could be. But I would have sworn he was headed for Harrisburg."
He was, Buford said. An idea was blowing in his brain, where there was time to think, time to breathe, and he was a patient man. He sat watching the Rebs withdraw, then he said, "Move your brigades into town. That will make the good citizens happy. I'm going to go have a look." He hopped the stone wall, rode down the long slope. He owed a message to Reynolds, back with the infantry, but that could wait until he was sure. He was old Army cavalry, Kentucky-born, raised in the Indian Wars. He was slow, he was careful, but he sensed something happening, a breathless something in his chest. He rode down through the town and out the road the Rebs had taken. There was no one in the streets, not even dogs, but he saw white faces at windows, a fluttering of curtains. There were no cows anywhere, or chickens, or horses. Reb raiding parties had peeled the land. He rode up toward the brick building with the cupola and topped a crest. Off in the distance there was another rise. He could see the Reb column withdrawing into a blue west. He saw the lone officer much closer now, sitting regally on horseback, outlined against a darkening sky. The man was looking his way, with glasses. Buford waved. You never knew what old friend was out there. The Reb officer took off his hat, bowed formally. Buford grimaced. A gentleman. A soldier fired at very long range. Buford saw his staff people duck, but he did not hear the bullet. He thought, they'll be back in the morning. Lee's concentrating this way. Only one road down through the mountains. Have to come this way. They will all converge here. In the morning. He turned in his stirrups, looked back at the high ground, the cemetery. The hills rose like watchtowers. All that morning he had seen nothing but flat ground. When the Rebs came in the morning, they would move onto those hills. And Reynolds would not be here in time. Gamble rode up, saluting. Tom Devon, the other brigade commander, arrived with a cheery grin. Gamble was sober sane. Devon was more the barroom type. Buford walked the horse back and forth along the rise. He said aloud, I wonder where their cavalry is. Devon laughed. The way old Stuart gets around, he could be having dinner in Philadelphia. Buford was not listening. He said abruptly, Get your patrols out. Scout this bunch in front of us, but scout up north. They'll be coming in that way from Carlisle. We've got a bit of light yet. I want to know before sundown. I think Lee's turned. He's coming this way. If I'm right, there'll be a lot of troops up the northern road, too. Hop to it! They moved. Buford wrote a message to John Reynolds, back with the lead infantry. Have occupied Gettysburg. Contacted large party of Reb infantry. I think they are coming this way. Expect they will be here in force in the morning. The word would go from Reynolds to Meade. With any luck at all, Meade would read it before midnight. From there it would go by wire to Washington. But some of Stuart's cavalry had cut the wires, and they might not be patched yet, so Washington would be in the dark and screaming its head off. God, that miserable Halleck. Buford took a deep breath. The great joy of the cavalry was to be so far away, out in the clean air, the open spaces, away from those damned councils. There were some moments, like now, when he felt no superior presence at all. Buford shook his head. He had been badly wounded in the winter. And possibly, as you got older, you had less patience instead of more. But he felt the beautiful absence of a commander. A silence above him. A windy freedom. The last Reb infantry walked away over the last rise. The Reb officer stood alone for a moment, then waved again and withdrew. The ridge was bare. Buford sniffed. Distant rain. The land around him was hot and dry, and the dust of the horses was blowing steadily up from the south as the wind began to pick up. And he could see a darkness in the mountains. Black sky. A blaze of lightning. A squadron of Gamble's cavalry moved slowly up the road. Buford turned again in the saddle, looked back again at the high ground. He shook his head once quickly. No orders. You are only a scout. Devon rode back, asking for instructions as to where to place his brigade. He had a cheery, boyish face, curly yellow hair. He had much more courage than wisdom. Buford said abruptly, accusing, "You know what's going to happen in the morning." "Sir?" "The whole damn Reb army is going to be here in the morning. They'll move right through town and occupy those damned hills," Buford pointed angrily, "because one thing Lee ain't is a fool. And when our people get here, Lee will have the high ground and there'll be the devil to pay."
Devon's eyes were wide. Buford turned. The moods were getting out of hand. He was no man for war councils or teaching either, and no sense in brooding to junior officers, but he saw it all with such metal brilliance. Meade will come in slowly, cautiously, new to command, wary of reputation. But they'll be on his back from Washington, wires hot with messages, attack, attack. So he will set up a ring around the hills, and when Lee's all nicely dug in behind fat rocks, Meade will finally attack if he can coordinate the army straight up the hillside, out in the open in that gorgeous field of fire, and we will attack valiantly and be butchered valiantly, and afterward men will thump their chests and say what a brave charge it was. The vision was brutally clear. He had to wonder at the clarity of it. Few things in a soldier's life were so clear as this, so black line etched that he could actually see the blue troops for one long bloody moment going up the long slope to the stony top as if it were already done in a memory already, an odd set stony quality to it, as if tomorrow had occurred and there was nothing you could do about it, the way you sometimes feel before a foolish attack, knowing it will fail, but you cannot stop it or even run away, but must even take part and help it fail. But never this clearly. There was always some hope. Never this detail. But if we withdraw, there is no good ground south of here. This is the place to fight.
Devon was watching him warily. Buford was an odd man. When he rode off there by himself, he liked to talk to himself, and he could see his lips moving. He had been too long out in the plains. He looked at Devon, finally saw him. He said abruptly, "No orders yet. Tell your men to dismount and eat. Rest. Get some rest." He rode slowly away to inspect the ground in front of him, between him and the rebels. "If we made a stand here, how long do you think we could hold? Long enough for John Reynolds to get here with the infantry? How long would that take? Will Reynolds hurry? Reynolds is a good man, but he might not understand the situation. How do you make him understand? At this distance. But if you hold, you at least give him time to see the ground. But how long can you hold against Lee's whole army? If it is the whole army. These are two very good brigades. You built them yourself. Suppose you sacrifice them and Reynolds is late. For Reynolds will be late. They're always late. Think on it, John. There's time. There's time." The land was long ridges with streams down in the dark hollows. Dismounted, along a ridge, with all night to dig in, the boys could hold for a while. Good boys. Buford had taught them to fight dismounted, the way they did out west, and the hell with this Stuart business, this glorious Murat charge. Try that against an Indian, that glorious charge, sabers a-shining, and he'd drop behind a rock or a stump and shoot your glorious head off as you went by. No. Buford had reformed his boys. He had thrown away the silly sabers and the damned dragoon pistols and given them the new repeating carbines, and though there were only 2,500 of them, they could dig in behind a fence and hold anybody for a while. But could they hold long enough?
Wherever he rode, he could look back at the hills, dominant as castles. He was becoming steadily more nervous. Easy enough to pull out. The job is done. But he was a professional. Damned few of them in this army. And he would not live forever. Rain clouds blotted the western sun. The Blue Mountains were gone. Gamble's first scouts rode back to report that the Rebs had gone into camp just down the road, about 3 miles out of Gettysburg. Buford rode out far enough to see the pickets for himself, then he rode back toward the Green Hills. He stopped by the seminary and had a cup of coffee. The staff left him alone. After that, he deployed the brigades. He had made no plans, but it didn't hurt to prepare. He told Gamble to dismount and dig in along the crest of the ridge just past the seminary, facing the Rebs who would come down that road. He posted Devon in the same way, across the road from the north. 3 men in line, every 4th man to fall back with the horses. He watched to see that it was done. They were weary men, and they dug in silently, and there was no music. He heard an officer grumbling. The damned fool wanted to charge the Reb picket line. Buford let loose a black glare. But it was a good line. It would hold for a while. Even old Bobby Lee. If John Reynolds got up early in the morning. It was darker now. Still very quiet. No need to make the decision yet. One could always pull out at the last minute. He grinned to himself, and the staff noticed his face and relaxed momentarily. Buford thought, "One good thing about cavalry, you can always leave in a hell of a hurry." Buford turned and rode back through the town, anxious for news from his scouts. People were moving in the streets. He collected a small following of happy boys, one small ragged girl with a beautiful, delicate face. He smiled down, but in the square ahead he saw a crowd, a speaker, a circle of portly men. He turned quickly away. He was no good with civilians. There was something about the mayors of towns that troubled him. They were too fat, and they talked too much, and they did not think twice of asking a man to die for them. Much of the East troubled Buford. A fat country. Too many people talked too much. The newspapers lied. But the women. Yeah. The women. He rode by one porch, and there was a woman in a dress of rose, white lace at the throat, a tall, blonde woman with a face of soft beauty, so lovely that Buford slowed the horse, staring before taking off his hat. She stood before a vined column, gazing at him. She smiled. There was an old man in the front yard, very old and thin and weak. He hobbled forward, glaring with feeble, toothless rage. "There's Johnny Rebs everywhere! Everywhere!" Buford bowed and moved on. Turned to look back at the beautiful woman who stood there watching him.
"Go back and say hello, General."
A coaxing voice, a grinning tone, lean Sergeant Corse, a bow-legged aide. Buford smiled, shook his head.
"With a woman, I bet you."
Buford turned away, headed toward the cemetery.
"If you'd like me to ride back, General, I'm sure an introduction could be arranged."
Buford chuckled. "Not tonight, Sergeant."
"The General could use a diversion. Begging your pardon, General, but you're too shy a lad for your age. You work too hard. These here quiet towns, now nothing ever happens here. And the ladies would be so delighted to see you, an important adventurous man such as you, who has seen the world. Now you'd be doing them a gracious favor just with your presence."
Buford smiled. "I'm about as shy as a howitzer."
"And similarly graceful, begging your pardon."
"Exactly." Buford began the slow ride up the hill to the cemetery.
"Ah," the sergeant said sadly, "but she was a lovely lass."
"She was that."
The sergeant brightened. "Well, then, if the General does not mind, I may just ride on over there myself later on, after supper, that is. If the General has no objections."
He pushed the glasses back up on his nose, straightened his hat, tucked in his collar. Buford said,
No objection, Sergeant.
Ah.
Buford looked.
And, what time would the General be having supper now?